but we must speak the truth in love, and we must be unafraid. And there's a climate of fear about speaking the truth, and you'll be suppressed, you'll be driven from the stage, you'll be driven like this. He resigned, but effectively he would have been forced out. We need a little bit more intestinal fortitude, a little bit more guts.
Welcome to a Lighthouse Faith podcast, Moving Forward in Truth and Love. I'm Lauren Green, Chief Religion Correspondent for Fox News Channel. You know, with so much news focused on what's happening in the political world, squabbles in Washington over health care and the budget and tax reform, stories about the persecution of Christians in the Middle East have become, well, sort of old news, or they just are not getting as much coverage. And it does give you the impression that things are going well with them, you know, but they are not. The displaced Christians are still fearing for their lives, and their numbers continue to dwindle in a land they've lived in since the time of the apostles. Someone who is in the trenches working for the displaced Christians is Father Benedict Keeley, is a Catholic priest and founder of Nazarene.org. It's an organization helping persecuted Christians in the Middle East. So welcome, Father Keeley.
Thank you very much again, Lauren, for having me.
I should say Father Ben or Father Keeley?
Father Ben.
Father Ben.
We're friends.
I like Father Ben, too. We're kind of friends, too. So, you know, you come in and out of town sometimes, and you call me up and you say, hey, can I talk to you? And here's the situation. And you write articles for Life Set News. And it's always really heart-wrenching, the stories that you tell about the situation for the Christians in the Middle East. Give me the rundown of what's going on now.
Well, it's exactly as you said in your introduction. It's sort of disappeared from the news cycle. And I think many people here think that all over the world we hear about the defeat of ISIS, which is true. The caliphate, I think it's very important, the distinction, the caliphate, the Islamic State in a particular location is being defeated. The ideology is not being defeated. All over the world, as Pope Francis has said, Christians are being persecuted at a rate we've not seen since the first centuries of the church. In fact, more. I read the other day or heard a figure of something like 100,000 Christians are dying a year. That's a phenomenal amount of people, men, women, and children. And so all over the world, Pakistan, India, Indonesia, Africa, yes, the Middle East, the cradle of Christianity, even France. I think of Father Jacques Hamel, the elderly priest who was beheaded saying Mass. Even in England, we've been warned. Your listeners will know that I'm an Englishman by the sound of my voice.
Really?
We've been warned. We've been warned not to wear the clerical collar in public because we could be attacked by jihadists. So it may have disappeared from the news cycle, but for the Christians of the Middle East, they are in danger, or I would use the word, of being exterminated. It's a genocide. We know that the U.S. government, the EU, many governments throughout the world have said this is a genocide, a wiping out of the Christian population. So things are not in good shape.
I want to get to the Middle East, but I want to stop in England first because you said some very, very scary things that I had not heard before. Mm-hmm. And one is that you've been warned in England not to wear your clerical collar because you might be attacked by jihadists.
Yes.
In England?
Yes. Yes, after the slaughter, the martyrdom of Father Jacques Hamel, as he was saying Mass in a little town in Normandy, France, I mean, an 85-year-old priest saying Mass, slaughtered by jihadists who did it in the name of the Islamic State, chopped his head off, cut his head off. We received directives, priests in the Church of England, Catholic Church, to be wary. And there was a warning to be careful of wearing your collar in public because people are being attacked. We know also that we hear also about lone wolves. Well, all the attacks are lone wolves. All the lone wolves are a member of the same pack.
Right.
If you can use a knife.
It's the same DNA.
Exactly. If you can use a knife, if you can use a bus, if you can use a van, a car, no one is really safe. But it's true. A priest, a minister is very identifiable. And it's unnerving, but we have to be identified. I mean, in the street, when I wear my collar, people are usually pleasant or they ask for help or sometimes they're not very nice, but we have to be ready for that. But England is, The population of England is changing rapidly. Sharia law is already being used in some parts of England, in some areas, and mosques are growing at an astonishing rate. Churches are closing, mosques are growing. What does that tell you? I think it tells you everything.
Well, it's also disturbing because I just read a story today about a church in England, or I mean, not a church, but a school in England, where the parents had waged some kind of protest against the number of Christian, organization that was sort of coming into the school and telling people and not ministering to the children, but just simply being a presence, and also that they don't want Church of England priests to be at the church at the school anymore, something that they'd done for 24 years. This is the land of the Church of England.
The Queen is still the head of the Church of England. Yes, it's extraordinary. It's you can be prejudiced. You can't be prejudiced against anyone anymore in England except Christians.
This is actually helping the jihadist movement because once they project themselves as the victim, you know, you can kind of do anything.
Yes. It's exactly it, political correctness, which is a form of fascism, as we know, is intolerance to the highest degree. It's basically true. Christians can't really speak in public. They can't speak about the defense of marriage. They can't speak about basic biblical doctrines. But funnily enough, for example, in our last election in England, the leader of the Liberal Democrat Party was kind of hijacked about his views on gay marriage. And
yeah, that was kind of one of those things where
Tim Farron.
Yeah, Tim. Yeah. He actually resigned rather than face this sort of battle because it seemed like he was facing it alone.
It was tragic. He had to resign because he said, I basically can't be a Christian in political life. However, they did not ask the 13 plus Muslim members of parliament in Britain what their views about gay marriage were. They focused on a Christian, an evangelical Christian.
Mm.
Funny. Something not quite right there.
I mean, you know, I know you're a Catholic priest, but the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, he's been under some heat as well because he refused to say, you know, something about, is homosexuality a sin or something like that? I don't remember, but I mean, let's leave that discussion aside. I want to go to the idea of why doesn't the Archbishop of Canterbury speak up a little bit more about the Christian faith? Because there was a priest who actually resigned his post because he was actually advisor to the Queen of England, and he actually resigned his post because of a verse from the Quran that was read in a church service that basically denied the divinity of Christ.
Yes, extraordinary phenomenon to have the Islamic. It was the Islamic call to prayer. There is only one God and Muhammad is his prophet. Saying that within a church, Muhammad is not his prophet in a church. Jesus Christ is the prophet, the ultimate prophet, the Son of God. Yes, he was a canon to the Queen, as he's called, and good man, God bless him, resigned his living. Why do they not speak up, Lauren? I have to say it's fear. It's a terrible fear of this labeling. You're an Islamophobe, you're intolerant, it's hate speech. No, we believe in the biblical doctrine of speaking the truth in love. We love all people. We love Muslims. We do not love the way they try to convert us by force, but we must speak the truth in love, and we must be unafraid. And there's a climate of fear about speaking the truth, and you'll be suppressed. You'll be driven from the stage. You'll be driven like this. He resigned, but effectively he would have been forced out. We need a little bit more intestinal fortitude, a little bit more guts.
I remember asking him because I did get him on the Spirited Debate show, and I asked, well, why doesn't the Queen speak up for Christianity as head of the Church of England?
And was his response coherent? Or?
Well, I think he said that it was because, first of all, she is not the head of the political arm of England. That's Parliament and the Prime Minister. And, of course, as you would know, the Archbishop of Canterbury is actually an appointment, a political appointment. It's not
Yes, the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister appoints him.
It is not a position that his fellow priests vote on.
Yeah.
So they're really under the banner, under the control of Parliament. So it's a much more political position than the Pope is the head of the Roman Catholic Church.
Well, I think that's why your founders were so wise about that separation of church and state, not having a state church, in other words, because, yes, it's a political appointment. So, excuse me, I've got a cough. I hope you have to cut that out.
We can take that out in the end.
Yeah, sorry.
So I understand. So this is a little bit of an interesting thing, and I think it's one that we're actually 500 years now in this Protestant Reformation. Perhaps there was a mistake there.
That's a good one, Laura.
Speaking as a good Protestant,
right? Good for you. That's an hold that thought for a long time.
So maybe I don't know. But the whole point of talking about England here is to say that it's not just England, but in America too, where all of these kinds of voices are sort of suppressed and giving aid basically to what's happening in the Middle East.
Well, last week I was lucky enough to be in Hungary. The Hungarian government, as many listeners may not know, is the only government in the world that has a specific government ministry for the persecuted Christians. Brave, brave government. There was a world conference. And at that, the EU minister, commissioner for religious liberty, which was also quite brave because he's a bureaucrat, spoke up about the indifference and ignorance about the persecution of Christians in the world. And he said, I thought it was a fantastic quote, "Ignorance and indifference are allies of evil." In other words, ignorance and indifference are allies of ISIS and all those who are murdering and slaughtering Christians. And we are indifferent. It's a terrible thing to say. If your brother or your sister, we believers, we Christians, our listeners who are Christians, if your brother or your sister was in trouble, your life would not be normal. You'd do something.
Right.
Well, our brothers and sisters are in trouble. Our brothers and sisters in the spirit. And to be indifferent to them is a sin. Simple. It's a sin. And we will be called to account for it. We cannot be indifferent. And this is going to go on for our entire lives. None of us who are living now will be dead long before this crisis is over.
But, you know, I was speaking to, I'm not quite sure I can remember who I was speaking with, but on that same vein, it was very, very important that, you know, when people ask, when secular people or sort of nominal religious people ask, well, why doesn't God do something about the injustice in the world and the pain and suffering? And I think the answer is basically what you said is that he sent us.
Mm-hmm.
And we will be the people who know that pain and suffering should not be the way are going to be the ones held accountable.
Absolutely.
Not the ones who perpetuate the pain and suffering, but the ones who know better and know that they have to alleviate the pain and suffering and go out and try to transform the world.
Well, St. Paul says in the letter to the Galatians, which has always been a scripture passage that's inspired me in my work, is, "Let us do good to all men, but first to the members of the household of the faith." In other words, of course we must care for everyone, we must feed everyone, all these good works of charity, but first to the members of the household of the faith. We must take care of our own, just as we would take care of our own families. It's not a sin. We take care of our families, we want to feed them and house them, and then we do our charitable work. It's exactly the same. And when we say, oh, out of sight, out of mind, or mm-hmm. I don't want to hear about these Christians, we will be judged. It's a blunt truth. We will be judged on that.
Yeah. You know, I want to speak to people who are listening to this who might think that's a little bit harsh to serve yourself before you serve others. I mean, it's just like in the plane where they tell you to put the mask on. It's like, you know, secure your own mask, and then you're able to secure the mask of your child, because if you faint or if you pass out, who's going to help your child? So I think it's the same idea, is that I have to feed my family so that they understand what it means to be fed. Or I have to love my family first so they understand what it means to love. You can't give someone else what you don't have.
Love your neighbor as yourself. You must love in that true sense your own self to love your neighbor. But we can't. That's why, in a sense, not pure, unfettered capitalism, but in a way, somehow the Western system is so far the best in the world, because when we make money, then we have our duty. And I know As a Catholic speaking, I'm always more impressed by my Protestant brothers and sisters. They're much more generous. They understand tithing, things like that. That's how we help our brothers and sisters. When we have of our blessings, we share our blessings. And all this, the harsh word is the word we don't want to hear and is not preached very often, is judgment.
Yeah.
We, you and I, all our listeners, all believers will one day stand before the Lord, who is a merciful judge, but he will reveal all. And yes. I don't want to have to say to him, when he says, "Why didn't you help your brothers and sisters in need?" I don't want to have to say, "Well, I was too busy, Jesus," or, "You know, I was taking care of business."
Yeah.
Well, the business is taking care of your brothers and sisters.
That's very true. You know, I heard a wonderful, wonderful sermon yesterday, and I have to tell you, I thought it was the most amazing way to put this, in a sense. And the minister was talking about looking at the whale show at like SeaWorld or something like that, and it was just the most fantastic thing. And that they were weeping at the sight of this beautiful sight of the whales leaping in for joy, and mm-hmm. it was people crying at this, and they were like, "Why are we crying at a bunch of whales, mm-hmm. you know, dancing?" And the end is that it's sort of this sort of trace memory of home, mm-hmm. of the joy of home, where even the whales leap for joy, mm-hmm. and the trees, you know, are singing, and all of those things. It's sort of this trace memory. And he said, and I remember the words and just struck me so true. He said, "We're all homesick."
Mm-hmm.
And it's mm-hmm. up to us, it's up to people to lead people home, because we're all homesick.
Well, I hate to tell you, I think he was probably stealing a line of G.K. Chesterton, who said
yes.
said it a little bit in a different way. But yes, we
another Englishman, by the way.
Exactly. I'm not pushing that, but yes, it's true. But yes, we're homesick. Home is with the Lord. And so in Scripture says we're in exile to a certain extent. This is also the great danger for us, and we all probably fall into it, that we think this is all there is. Even when we believe, we still think this is all there is. And I think perhaps what one of the great gifts, because I always try to tell people when I speak about the persecuted Christians, is we always think about what we can do for them. But I always try and focus believers on what can they do for us. And they, for us, I think, give us the example of being strengthened in our faith. And they remind us, when you're willing to die for your faith, when you're willing to have everything stripped from you, including your wedding ring. I heard stories of people having their, old ladies having their wedding rings ripped off their fingers. When you're willing to do that for your faith, that should give us in the West, who are still blessed, still we have troubles and struggles, but no one is cutting our head off yet.
Right.
That strengthens us in our faith. It tells us what it's really all about, because they know that home is with the Lord, and they're willing to die for mm-hmm. the Lord, for their faith. It's a beautiful thing.
Let's go back to those Christians, because the dwindling number of Christians, at one point it was about 2 million in Iraq, and now it's down to about 200,000.
200,000, and slowly but surely, what's going on now at the moment in Kurdistan, where most of the Christians escaped to, is ISIS is being defeated, and they may be even in more trouble now, because Kurdistan is being fought over by the Iraqis, by the Iranians, by the Turks, in a sense, and the Christians are a little tiny minority that no one really seems to care about, and this might be the final nail in the coffin for Christians.
You know, you write in the article, why is the U.S. government continuing the failed policies of the Obama administration? So I want to say that I actually contacted the State Department to get their side of this, you know, what's happening mm-hmm. with you guys over there. And I have not heard back, and hopefully I can give some kind of disclaimer when we actually, you know, launch this podcast about or at least give their side of what's going on. But what is the U.S. government doing? What is their policy? What have they not done, or what should they be doing?
The policy is hard to describe, because they are they're sort of seeming to back away from involvement. The Iraqi government is almost becoming a proxy of Iran. This is what's so extraordinary, that Iran seems to be winning in the Middle East. All this wasted blood. The whether you agreed with the invasion of Iraq, I mean, the blood of our soldiers, American soldiers, British soldiers, many others, it's a terrible thing to say, to be that has been wasted. The Trump administration, we had great hopes for, many Christians had, and I can tell you from personal experience in Iraq, listening to the Christians there, they had tremendous hope.
Mm-hmm.
But so far, it's been a lot of talk. President Trump, before the election, said he would be the best president ever to defend Christians. Vice President Pence, who's a good believer, we know, has said that it would be a foreign policy priority of the administration to defend Christians. So far, we're almost in a year into the administration, since the election,
yeah.
We've seen very little.
Vice President Pence is speaking at the Events of Christians, which is coming up this week, and I know by the time we air this, it will be behind us. But that seems to be a good effort to get out there and say, this is what we're going to do. I mean, it's entirely possible, and I'm hoping that he'll make some kind of policy statement as well.
He has spoken clearly. He has said on a number of occasions that defense of Christians, defense of religious and minorities, victims of genocide is a priority. But as I say, you must translate words into actions. The president was elected by many people because he wasn't a politician. People have got used to it. It's a given that politicians fail to keep their promises. He was elected because he wasn't a politician. But we need him to keep his promises. And I have to say that he's known for being not politically correct. So perhaps the defense of Christians is not politically correct, but he's got to go for it. They are in danger. They need a champion. I would hope that he would want to go down in history as the president who saved the Christians, unlike FDR, who turned those boats. It's a historical fact. We know Franklin Roosevelt turned those boats of Jews away.
Right.
I would think President Trump would want to go down in history as the man who saved the Christians. I mean, God knows what a legacy. Presidents are always worried about their legacy. What a fantastic legacy to be the man that the president that saved Christians in the Middle East. And that's going to take money, and that's going to take possibly troops, but I don't think we need many troops there. But it's certainly going to take a shift in the Washington environment.
You know, you talk about in your articles about the Nineveh Plains, which many people don't know about. I mean, Nineveh is in one of the areas of the Old Testament, talking about what happened in the Nineveh Plains. Tell us what happened with the Nineveh Plains.
Nineveh.
Hard word to say sometimes if you're saying it quickly.
Especially after a drink or two. But you haven't
but
had
I have
any.
Not
you haven't
had anything
any
like that.
It's early in the day.
Yes.
The Nineveh Plain is where, yes, any believer, any Jewish believer and Christian believer knows that Jonah went to preach in Nineveh. Nineveh is Mosul. We hear Mosul a lot on our news. Nineveh is Mosul. It's where Jonah was buried. It's where ISIS blew up the tomb of Jonah. The Nineveh Plain, which is a plain outside Mosul, that area is where Christians have lived for nearly 2,000 years. St. Thomas the Apostle and his disciples founded Christianity in what present-day Iraq. This is also what many people seem to forget, that they almost think we in the West brought them Christianity. It's the exact opposite. They're always surprised, for example, that Christians are speaking Arabic. There's this thing, a mindset that only Muslims speak Arabic. Well, no, Christians were speaking it first. The Nineveh Plain is where the Christians have lived for nearly 2,000 years, and ISIS drove them all out in the summer of 2014, drove them all out from all their villages and towns and cities. Some are returning, but now they have the whole, as I said earlier on, the whole question of who's going to protect them. They may be lost from their ancient homeland. That's the fear. It's very depressing, and many want to leave. That's the reality. Many want to leave because they just see the future is war, and they want to raise their children in peace.
How did we get to this point where Christians, a small minority, have become a sort of political pawn in the Middle East?
I think it's because
not worse than a pawn, because nobody's fighting for them.
No, that's the central point. That they have no. A priest said to me way back, I think when I first went there, he said, "We are just weak. We have no one to defend us. We actually have we have no oil. I mean, there's nothing in a sense that the Christians could, except that they were always, to use a biblical term, a leaven in society. Christians were usually slightly better educated. They were peacemaking bridge in many ways between, for example, the Shia and the Sunni Muslims. And they have lived in peace. This is, we're not perfect, but the Christians have lived in peace with their neighbors. And to have that removed, apart from the awfulness of the very cradle of Christianity disappearing, to have that leaven is going to leave two very opposing groups, the Shia and the Sunni, with no one in the middle. It's going to be a disaster for the King Abdullah of Jordan, who is a direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, has said that himself. He said to lose Christians in the Middle East will be a disaster just for civil society.
Yeah.
So it's even wider than caring about our brother believers and sister believers. It's about making a place of peace and harmony. But in the broad political terms, it's they have no power. That's the problem. They have no power.
What's happening in Syria? That's a whole other issue with Assad and the quote rebels. And it seems as though we're not quite sure who the evil one is at this point.
Well, a frequent visitor and an expert on that area told me once, he said, they're all monsters. You just have to decide which monster you're going to work with, which is realpolitik. And realpolitik is not as we want the world to be, it's the way it is. And I have to say, it's not politically correct, but all three patriarchs of Damascus, all three church leaders in Syria have called for sanctions to be lifted against the government of Syria, not to support the regime of President Assad, but because the people are suffering. Assad has won, and again, speaking in terms of realpolitik, the rest of the world is accepting that. Governments are accepting it. Even the Saudi Arabians, who have sworn enemies, are accepting it. That's the way it is. But the truth that the media is not printing or broadcasting is where the Assad regime is winning, which is actually now he's winning in large parts of the country, Christians are returning. They're in safety. No, I don't think a single Christian would say he's a good man or the
right.
ideal, but they do say we're safer under him than under anyone else. I met a young man, I wrote about it in my article, a young man from Raqqa, the very center of the Islamic State, who told me that when the so-called Arab Spring began, he was out in the streets protesting against Assad. He's now a firm supporter, not because he thinks he's a good man. He said, but we've seen the alternative. That's al-Nusra, that's Islamist extremism, that's chopping Christians' heads off. So the truth is we should be trying now to help the Syrian people. We can still target if we the regime, but Christians are returning, and surely this is what most of the governments are saying. We want refugees to go back, and they are returning, they are rebuilding, and church leaders are asking us to help them do that. But we're not hearing this.
You know, it seems as though this is the repeat of historically what the Christians felt about Assad before the rebels got into having more power and having, you know, being propped up by, I suppose, Iran and maybe even the Soviet Union, I mean, or Russia, I guess.
It was, yeah.
Yeah. But this has been the reason why historically the Christians actually sided with Assad, because he protected them, even though he might not have been the best.
It seems to be, and we can judge, we can look from our comfortable homes here in the West and even from our newsrooms and make judgments about what's right and wrong. It seems to be in the Middle East, whether it's good or bad, that strong men are needed. In Iraq, they preferred Saddam Hussein, not because he was good, but he kept the peace.
Well, this is what I was going to ask you about then. And was Saddam Hussein a stabilizing figure for Christians? You know, it seems odd to be asking this right now because, you know, or maybe it's the most stupid question to be asking in light of the fact that, you know, we took out Saddam Hussein because of his evil regime or something like that. But your article seems to suggest that it was actually a better deal under Saddam Hussein.
I think the most important thing, I read that one of the cardinals of the church went to Iraq early on, bravely, in about April or May of 2015. And his words I've always tried to have echoing in my head. He said, when we speak about the persecution of the Christians, we should speak with transparency and complete honesty. Now, that might mean that it's uncomfortable. So I want to tell you what I hear from the people on the ground. And a great priest, I'm not sure if you've met him, but a wonderful man, Father Douglas Barzi, who was tortured by...
I've not met him, but I
know
who
story.
He is. I know his story.
A great man, a hero of the faith. He was kidnapped. He was beaten with a hammer. They broke his vertebrae in his back. They broke his teeth. Father Douglas said to me, there's bad and there's worse. Which would you rather live under? So under Saddam, it was bad. Now it's worse. Which would you rather live under? And I'm sure the Christians of Syria would say the same thing. There's bad and worse. I'd rather live under bad than worse. So no one pretends, but it's the same in Egypt, that the Copts are protected a little bit more by a strong man. It was even perhaps in Libya. God knows Gaddafi was an awful man, but there seems to be a need to have a strong man to try and keep society stable. No one would pretend it's good. No one would pretend, but we tend to look from the West, from a bit of a high horse about all of
but
this.
You've kind of described the situation in the United States, and I know a lot of people will probably object to this, the reason why perhaps Donald Trump won the presidency. This is something I had heard from many, many Christians, evangelical Christians, who felt that they were being severely marginalized in this country, and a lot of legal stuff going on. You might be able to protect the churches and the big institutions who have religious liberty under their belt, but you can't protect, you know, just regular people who want to go, you know,
bake a cake, or
have businesses, you know, that express themselves. So this is, I think, one of, and I've tried to explain this to people. I said, you know, I think this is probably one of the reasons why you know people on the left kind of scratch their heads and go, well, I don't know how this man won. And I suggest that perhaps it was because they felt that they could be protected better by someone like him, even though he's certainly.
You're surely not comparing Donald Trump to Saddam Hussein.
No,
or
I'm just kidding with you. No, please. I hope I don't get any emails of people suggesting that they're even in the same room with each other. I don't suggest that, but there's
that's English humor, just listeners, just so you know, that's English humor. Lauren did not suggest that for 1 minute.
But it sounds like the same scenario in that, okay.
I think it's you're right. I mean, I agree with you 100%. But also, I think it's that sense of people feeling that the little people were feeling that we're not represented. And they need, this is the land of the free, the home of the brave, all those beautiful ideals of the founders, and they are Judeo-Christian ideals. And to have those sort of things despised, and Europe is way ahead, as you know, Europe is way ahead on this in terms of, that's why, as I mentioned, Hungary, the Prime Minister of Hungary, who gets very bad publicity from the secular press, he said a great line in his speech last week. He said, we're going to try and preserve a little slice, that was the word he used, a little slice of Christianity in Europe, because Christianity has been marginalized in Europe. He said, in Hungary, we are proud of our Christian roots, 1,000 years of Christianity in Hungary. The crown of St. Stephen of Hungary is in the center of the parliament building, which is a very profound thing. That's where the law rests, as it were. It's symbolic that his crown is in the very center. So the power does not reside, in a sense, in the prime minister. It's the Christian roots of Hungary. And I think the people of the United States also said, this is a Judeo-Christian country, and we just want to be allowed to live our faith.
Yeah. Well, we've kind of run out of time here. Not really, but I think usually about this time we kind of say, oh, let's just, you know, wrap this up. But I want you to explain how people can help, because I'm sure of people who are listening to this podcast are saying, well, how can I help? How can I be proactive and do what needs to be done to help this situation?
I would say two things. First, I think you have to have some passion. You must have passion for your brethren, for your faith. Passion will lead you into action. Passion and prayer, two P's. Prayer is also does not preclude or exclude action. Prayer should lead to action. Determination then would be to do something. Yes, how? Very simple. Prayer, charity, solidarity. We give, we help. We can support particular charities. I have a little charity which you've been kind enough to publicize.
It's called Nazarene.org, by the way. I want to actually say that because I think it's a very interesting charity. It's a Nazarene, but it's not spelled like
it's
I want to spell it.
NASAREAN.org.
There we go. Okay.
You can do that. But what I would really encourage our listeners and believers especially, but all our listeners, is to not let this go. This may disappear from the news cycle, but daily prayer for the rest of our lives, trying to help in some small way. Small is beautiful. You can do little things.
Okay. I want to thank you so much, Father Benedict Keeley. He's a Catholic priest and working, as I say, in the trenches of trying to help displaced Christians in the Middle East. His organization is helping persecuted Christians. It's called Nazarene.org, and I encourage you to go on there and find information about what's happening in the Middle East. But you can also go to places like Open Doors, you can .org. You can also go to In Defense of Christians. It's IDC.org, and check that out as well.
And also, if I could add, you could go to someone wonderful like Franklin Graham and his Samaritan's Purse.
Absolutely. They're doing a lot of work as well. So there's a lot of organizations out there that are helping in this situation, and so a lot of ways to get involved. So I want to thank you so much, and thank you so much for listening to Lighthouse Faith Podcast. I'm Lauren Green of Fox News Channel. Thank you so much.